I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, sampling the uproar rising from American campuses. It's a full-blown leaderless movement by now in an established American tradition, but still contested, still finding its way, looking for its pattern. Columbia and USC have canceled graduation ceremonies. Many more schools are threatening suspensions or worse if students don't remove their encampments. In our neighborhood, Harvard Yard is encamped, closed to people without Harvard ID. Harvard students are catch-as-catch-can.
We've been out here for 2 weeks. It's been great so far, despite intense and scary tactics being used by members of the administration to intimidate students.
What do you think they're afraid of?
I think they're afraid of the power of a student movement. They're afraid of a change in the tide of both student opinion and public opinion. I think they're afraid of our city, our students, our community, our country, and the world, understanding that these institutions that are kind of upheld as leaders in the world, even such universities can be complicit in things like genocide, apartheid, occupation, war crimes that are happening in Palestine and elsewhere.
I'm not afraid of what they are going to do to me. I am afraid of what I will be complicit in if I remain silent.
MIT, by contrast, is wide open, noisy with speech making, and still cheerful around a 10-foot sign proclaiming Jews for Gaza. We are dropping in conversationally on faculty players we know on either side of the country, Sophia Azeb at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and Zachary Samelin at New York University in Manhattan. Santa Cruz is encamped in tents and abuzz with notably civil and inclusive debates about rights, wrongs, and history, all the arguments about Palestine that Congress doesn't have. You could wonder, what if the 19-year-olds who have preempted the conversation from the campuses are, in fact, the leaders we have been looking for? Start with you, please, Sophia Azeb, professor of race and ethnic studies at Santa Cruz. I want you to describe what you see out your window, out of your tent, so to speak.
As of today, the sixth day of our student strike, our students' energy has not flagged at all. They are continuing their pretty rigorous schedule of educational programming, direct action training, mapping out histories, especially local histories, of sit-ins, encampments, student strikes, and protest. And it's been quite a pleasure to witness and be present for. And I have honestly been more at peace in the last 6 days at this encampment than I have felt in the last 7 months as a Palestinian American professor at UC Santa Cruz.
That's a statement. How did you get there to a place of peace?
So as a member and co-founder of our campus's Faculty for Justice in Palestine, we had been entrusted to a certain extent by many of the student organizers, who it's important to note are organizing as a coalition of many student groups and many students unaffiliated with any campus organizations. We had been entrusted to some extent by them to assist in some of the preparations that faculty would be best for, which is to observe, to parlay when necessary with administrators or university staff, and crucially, to prepare in the hopefully unlikely case of mass arrests or suspensions of our students. And this is really crucial at Santa Cruz because housing is at such a premium here and is quite difficult for students to arrange. So a good percentage of the students in the encampment are reliant on student housing, as well as student family housing. Many of our students are non-traditional students, first generation. They have children, they have families, they've come back to school after a long time. And most of our students are local. So they come from farm working communities. They come from immigrant communities and neighborhoods. They come from Oakland, LA, San Francisco, Salinas, Watsonville, and so on. And what's been really wonderful is to witness how all of these different student demographics have come together in what seems like a kind of seamless way, although I know it's a lot of hard work. And it's been just a kind of honor to be welcomed into this space. And it feels pretty nice to be in such a convivial environment after so many months of tension and difficulty.
Can I ask, where are Jewish students in this space, in this conversation?
They're leading. Many of the organizers of our encampment and most of the encampments around the country and the world are, in fact, Jewish anti-Zionist students. Hmm. You know, there's a huge banner among many on the Redwood Lounge building, UC Santa Cruz's campus is in the middle of the Redwood Forest, that proclaims Jews for a free Palestine. And it's also important to note that, you know, there are very many Jews of color here that were already invested in conversations about anti-racism, about critiquing white supremacy, about diversifying the student body, the curriculum that's offered here, the faculty that are teaching the curriculum, as well as addressing that many of the problems with housing and income inequality and houselessness in Santa Cruz are directly related to histories of inequality that in many ways stem from racial inequality first.
Is there room for Zionist Jews in this conversation on this campus? That is to say, Israel-friendly Jews, shall we say?
There's certainly an abundant amount of room for Israel-friendly Jews in this conversation. And in fact, they've been at the center of this conversation for the last 7 months. I will note that the vast majority of folks who are coming, let's say, through the camp to maybe ask questions, often, however, it's to maybe stoke some controversy or instigate, have been very gently and generously, I think, handled by the students at this camp, especially our Jewish students who are present. But the vast majority of them are not students, in fact. They're coming from beyond the campus, often beyond Santa Cruz, simply to be present. And I think attempt to trip up our students by, raising the question of Judaism and anti-Semitism. But the fact is that there are so many Jewish students present here that it's not really the gotcha that I think they were planning. But yes, there's plenty of room for pro-Israel Jews in this conversation, and they have been at the center of it. And so I think these students, whether or not they are Jewish, are taking the opportunity to center these voices.
Sophia Azeb and Zach Samelin at New York University, let me tell you what I'm listening for. I'm listening for a turn, not just in the American mood, but in American performance, thinking, behavior. Kids camped out, not speaking singly on social media, affiliating day after day, night after night, in an extended conversation, particularly at a time when we almost despaired of American politics and its ability to talk straight about, as John F. Kennedy said, the unfinished business of the country. What's happening? Are you feeling a turn in the way we talk about stuff? Zach Samelin, I think this is a question for you. Professor of English, author of a book called The Masses Are Revolting, which in fact was about mass culture in Europe in the 19th century. Do you sense a turn here?
I certainly do. You know, one of the things that I agree with so strongly about Sophia's characterization of the encampment at Santa Cruz, and I think certainly at NYU as well, and I was also up at Columbia a few weeks ago before they were shut down by the police, is that these students are coming together, Jewish students, Muslim students, anti-imperialist students, anti-police students, people who are trying to make a space on campus where they can have discussions that I think are otherwise, in a sense, being shut down or precluded in the sort of dominant American political culture. What these students are doing is making a space for dialogue and thought that is really hard to come by. You know, one of the things that was so beautiful about the second encampment at NYU, which lasted for almost an entire week before it was shut down by the police this past Friday, May 2nd, at 6 o'clock in the morning, was just the sense that Bleecker Street, where these students had camped out on this throughway to down to Houston, was abuzz with a kind of New York energy that I haven't seen in this city in decades because of the way that public space has been heavily policed and corporatized over the last 30 years since the Giuliani administration. There were people stopping by who had no idea what was going on, and they were just asking questions. And the students were so knowledgeable, and they were so friendly and ready to speak and share information. There were people coming by to shout obscenities at the students, and they were also met, like Sophia said, with a kind of insistent desire to de-escalate and to converse. What was so striking to me was that you really were seeing thought and dialogue take place after 7 months of so much repressive energy that has been dedicated to shutting down dialogue, to keeping people from saying things, to keeping people from thinking in public in a certain sense.
This is fascinating. Can I just say the coverage is so unlike what you're describing, Zach. I wonder why. This is treated in so many ways leading up to the police entries on campus, which we all wonder about, but it's treated as a diseased, maybe a dangerous turn that students are in the height of spring pre-exam are acting up for sure, some of them under tents on their own campuses. Why the bad press?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons. There's certainly a lot of opportunism, you know, sort of the way that the mainstream media has covered the genocide in Gaza over the last 7 months has been extremely tendentious. The New York Times has been, I think, you know, as they were during the Vietnam War, as they were during the first and second wars in Iraq, you know, extremely bellicose in the way that they present American aggression. They're extremely interested in claims about terrorism and so on and so forth. That sort of set the tone as early as October and prior to it, certainly. But I think there's also been just so much opportunism. I mean, right now, the police in New York City have declared that they're going to start a counterterrorism investigation of students at Columbia and NYU and the New School for their encampments. Now, to me, this is just extremely wild allegation that hasn't been substantiated. They went on TV, the deputy chief of police went on TV with a handmade, blown up copy of the very short introduction to terrorism, the very short introduction series. There's also a very short introduction to literary theory, very short introduction to French literature, right? And so on and so forth. These are not how-to books. They're works of scholarship. This one was written by an accomplished historian. And they went on TV and said, oh, well, we found this in the encampment. It wasn't even the actual copy. It was like an enlarged copy that he had made or somebody had made and given to him so that it would be more televisable. And I think that the police in New York have long been interested in quashing protests and vilifying students and professors, in squashing free speech and squashing any kind of anti-war sentiment. That combined with the kind of pro-Israeli and outright anti-Palestinian sentiments in the mainstream media has produced a kind of very sick and obscene combination of forces that can't stand the image of Jewish and Muslim students or of, you know, students celebrating Passover and the evening call to prayer in the same space. You know, that was what was happening at the first encampment at NYU on April 22nd, when the police came in and raided and arrested 133 people, 20 faculty members among them, staff members, scores of students, members of our community who were using the Islamic Center for prayer that evening, spouses and family members of faculty who live in the buildings across the street. They were all swept up in this mass arrest. Students were pepper sprayed. Student journalists were pepper sprayed. Police were throwing chairs at people. It was pandemonium. What was going on right at the moment when the police entered was that the Passover Seder had just finished and the Maghreb evening call to prayer had just begun when the police entered Gould Plaza, which is kind of the closest thing that NYU has to a quad shaped space on campus. It's a plaza in front of the business school that opens onto West 4th Street and has a small back entrance onto West 3rd Street. And so it's usually a kind of open to the public thoroughfare.
You yourself were arrested, Zach. How did that happen?
As I said earlier, faculty were being allowed onto that plaza up until the moment when we were declared to be trespassing by the police. So I had been at that plaza to support students and, again, like Sophia said, sort of act as a kind of observer of the events throughout the day with a number of my colleagues. Myself and a number of my colleagues also took our small children, family members to the plaza. There was a lot of singing, writing on the ground with chalk. You know, it was a really beautiful scene. We came back after dinner with my daughter, who was having so much fun that she wanted to return at 7:30. We were permitted access to the plaza by campus security, and colleagues were, again, permitted access up until the moment that the police entered the plaza. So we were all arrested for trespassing, though on the other hand, we were permitted by campus security to enter the plaza up until the very moment in which they called the police in. So there's a question, I think, about the coherence of the campus security response. The chief of campus security was on the premises while faculty were being admitted, and he was negotiating with the deputy chief of police in Manhattan. So what happened was, again, as the Passover Seder ended, people put away their matzah and haroset, and then the Muslim students began the evening call to prayer. And at that moment, there was the loud sound of dozens of police vehicles blooping their sirens, and they entered, I don't know quite how many, but dozens upon dozens of the NYPD's strategic response group entered through the back entrance from West 3rd Street. That is the counterterrorism and anti-protest unit of the NYPD.
I didn't know they had such a thing.
Counterterrorism and anti-protest. It's a kind of, in literary studies, you would call that a kind of metonymy, where you're trying to link two things together through association rather than through any kind of conceptual coherence. So there's a kind of intent in the very nature of that unit of the police department to criminalize dissent and criminalize protest. There were four or five or six large NYPD buses. All the officers were in riot gear and they had zip ties. So at that point, it was clear that arrests were forthcoming. And students formed a ring around the encampment where Muslim students were praying, and faculty formed a line. About 20, 25 of us formed a line to try and prevent the police from coming in and arresting and ultimately from assaulting our students, especially while they were engaged in an act of prayer, which I believe is a protected civil liberty. Yeah, at that point, they played their long-range acoustic device recording, informing us all that we were trespassing. People did have an opportunity at that moment to leave, although there was only one egress and there was quite a bit of pandemonium. I chose to remain, linking arms with my colleagues, and we said to the police, you can find a recording of me saying this, I don't see how we can be trespassing in front of our own offices.
In front of my own house, in front of my own office.
In front of our apartments, all of our neighbors were watching. I could see my wife waving to me in the window of our apartment building across the street, and I was able to wave back to her before I was zip-tied. Then people were taken downtown. There was predictable racist behavior on the parts of cops. I think some of my colleagues, especially the administration at NYU and other universities, they seemed to think that there might be some kind of cleaned up concierge service that university personnel can get from the police department in New York and elsewhere. But there's really only one way to call the police. And they come in and there's violence, and they bring the violence. They bring the criminalization. And that was what took place. An older colleague of mine in his late 70s was zip tied so tightly that he couldn't feel his fingers by the time that we got down to central booking. Another colleague, a black colleague of mine, was targeted for the first arrest made by the deputy chief of police himself, who walked up to my colleague, a black woman, and said to one of the riot cops, he got up in her face, pointed at her and said, arrest her first. Other colleague was so destabilized when we got down to One Police Plaza that she threw up. There's just, again, like I say, there's only one version of police violence, and that is the one you get. And if you call in 100, 200 riot cops, that's definitely what you get. So I really do think that there's a sense in which these images of a kind of possible future in which people are able to think and able to speak and coexist and come together around this issue, around the desire to end a genocide and the desire to peacefully end one of the most intractable colonial political problems of the modern period, the world is in a sense incapable of processing that image. And I think the students, on the other hand, are driving this forward, and it is a new turn, and it brings together energies from the Occupy movement, from the, you know, huge protest movement against the Iraq war and the war on terror, as well as the anti-war movements going back to the Vietnam era, and a long history of Palestine organizing in the United States and abroad.
Zach, let me ask, is it controversial for you as a faculty member and a man of Jewish heritage, as I remember, to be taking such an active and outspoken role here?
Well,
is that difficult for you?
It's not controversial to my family. It's not controversial to, you know, my community. But I would say that NYU has been engaged in a kind of 7 months long campaign of repression and censorship in order to shut down pro-Palestinian speech on campus. Now, we have an extremely large group of faculty and staff who have organized under the aegis of the Faculty and Staff for Justice in Palestine group here at NYU. And we've been pushing back against this censorship nonstop for 7 months. We've been attending disciplinary hearings for students who have been penalized and suspended and called in for infractions as minor as pulling down posters. We had a Black faculty member who was fired for pulling down posters. We have had students and faculty called in for disciplinary hearings simply for reading Palestinian poetry aloud in the lobby of the Bobst Library, which is not like a tranquil place. It's, you know, the lobby of this big library. Mm-hmm. I would say it's controversial in the sense that the administration of NYU has been engaged in trying to stop pro-Palestinian speech from taking place and pro-Palestinian activism from taking place in and around the campus. That said, I think there's actually overwhelming agreement among students and faculty that pepper spraying students for having a peaceful demonstration has crossed a line. And I think that there's overwhelming agreement among students and faculty that bringing in police to deal with demonstrations in any context crosses a line and is inappropriate and contravenes NYU's legally binding memorandum of understanding with the New York Police Department, which states that police are only supposed to be called in when there's a threat of a violent felony.
Sophia Azeb at Santa Cruz, everything you and Zach are describing could be told under the heading of a great revival of democratic belief in our society at the street level. We could be seeing a revival of the democratic spirit, not only at its best, but at a moment when we worry about the democratic flame going out across the map. What I'm hearing is not just this leaderless movement breaking out in so many forms, but with a peculiarly American, I want to say, confidence, assurance. It's an old style of political action, improvisation, experiment, no rule book exactly, but a spirit of intensity, fair play overall, as you're describing it, learning not to be afraid. Parenthetically, Harvard Law Professor Randy Kennedy, an activist of long standing in the law school, described in a conversation with The New Yorker an atmosphere of nothing but fear on the Harvard campus when it comes to talking about issues involving Palestinians and Jews in the Middle East. The whole nexus of Arab, Israeli, Jewish, and non-Jewish issues in the world. What if we're just seeing it wrong? I wonder at the way this whole moment is being described to us. Do you wonder?
Certainly. A couple of days ago, I was present at the request of some of the student organizers at the encampment at UC Santa Cruz for a visit from a sort of low-level administrator who was describing how fearful the chancellor of UCSC was of the encampment. Notably, the chancellor has never stopped to look at the encampment. It's in the middle of our campus. It's easily accessible to anyone. They're not blocking anyone's path through. They have a beautiful library, the Rafah El-Arir Memorial Library, as so many other encampments do, in honor of Rafat El-Arir, who was a Palestinian professor and poet who was murdered in Gaza with his family. And there's medic tents and very well-stocked kitchen to which anyone in the community is welcome. And in fact, many people in the community have taken advantage of fresh food in moments of like extreme food scarcity on this campus amongst our students, as well as, you know, among houseless people. There is a learning space, actually two now. The students have expanded the camp so that there are two classrooms in which they and community members and organizers and professors sometimes are invited in to lead teach-ins and study sessions. There are wonderful kind of community spaces that spring up in the nearby parking lot, for instance. Community members come. There was a mariachi band the first night of the camp. The great thing about living in Santa Cruz is so many of the emerging cultural communities in California have kind of come out and celebrated. It is a sort of revival, perhaps, of a democratic spirit, if we would want to say it. But I'm just thinking more of like our local history here in the larger Bay Area, where You know, in 1968, a massive coalition led by the Black Student Union at San Francisco State College, but informed by former members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, of local labor unions, the Mexican American Student Association, Asian American Political Alliance, Third World Liberation Front, began what was then the longest student strike in the history of this country, in order to demand primarily the field that I work in, which is critical race and ethnic studies, as well as the field that I'm trained in, which is Black studies. And so our students are really mobilizing this history that they very deliberately studied and understand quite deeply to mark a path that says, listen, this has happened before. Universities were afraid then. The state was afraid then. And we cannot be afraid because they are holding all the fear for us. They're mobilizing all the fear. It's actually kind of phenomenal to see how afraid university administrations and state officials and city officials are of like 17 to 20 some odd year old students who are simply educated about their country's history and about their local histories. And are mobilizing with labor organizers and ethnic studies histories and immigration rights communities and all of these sorts of coalition-based movements from the relatively recent past to the further past. And they're so frightened. And it is, I think, to go back to what Zach was observing earlier, it's a testament to this longer history of the demonization of anti-imperial, anti-war, anti-racist movements in this country. Or, you know, simply put, organizing that has demanded that universities and the state live up to its lofty claims of an egalitarian society. Yeah. And looking at that student strike and looking at these encampments, and I have to say, I'm reflecting on this history while right now at UC San Diego and at UCLA, riot cops are mass arresting students, faculty, and legal observers. At the University of California, San Diego, there was a sniper posted on campus. Again, there are no weapons in these encampments. There are no arms whatsoever. There is no threat. And yet, these administrations are calling in police, likely at the behest of California Governor Gavin Newsom, to shut down these peaceful encampments that have become actually the hub of intellectual and social and cultural life at these universities. And I have never seen so many students invested in learning as I have now. Students that are like coming to attend voluntarily a long study session on Edward Said.
Yeah.
Who routinely would skip my class in a real life, you know, curricular situation. And I really welcome that kind of energy and excitement about learning, because to them, this is a situation where learning, studying matters. It's knowledge that they can mobilize, and they are mobilizing it.
Zach Samelin, I want to come back to a tiny little point you made, but rang a bell with me. We're talking about a tone of language, and you're reporting it very civil, engaged, serious. But I'm interested in body language, too. You speak about people forming a ring. We've also read about human chains. This is a long way from the notorious isolation of social media, where you're just blasting off vitriol, oftentimes, into oblivion. But in this case, these are real people, flesh and blood, friends, becoming friends, and discovering a kind of solidarity. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. I would say that these students have made it possible to create a kind of space in which people can relate to each other in ways that are not subject to the kinds of pressures and prohibitions on thinking and speaking about Palestine and about American imperialism and about Israeli colonialism that we're subject to in other spaces. There's a kind of incredible social effect, which is that you go into this space and, like Sophia is describing, students are able to learn. They're able to speak. They're disinhibited from the kinds of censorship that has come to characterize the classroom space and the campus space around this country. It produces connections and solidarities and forms of getting to know people, even at the level of just like getting to know people in other parts of a, you know, university like NYU that has campuses sort of flung around different parts of New York and in Brooklyn. And that is a material fact that has incredible political potential just to bring people together who aren't usually in a position to occupy the same space, and then to give them the license to think and to speak in that space when that license is being withheld around the city. It was tremendous. And I would say that part of that is also about discovering the material ways in which this country and the fate of people in this country has been braided together with the fate of people in Palestine. Students, when they talk about wanting, you know, universities to disclose and divest the ways in which their $1 billion, $10 billion endowments are complicit in the genocide of the Palestinian people, they're wanting to understand the way that our social lives as people in this country and this empire are connected to people in Gaza, in the West Bank, right, in the Golan Heights, right? I mean, I think there's a really important form of discovery about our connections to what's going on in Israel, Palestine. It's potentially transformative, and that's why it's being met with so much repressive energy. I feel very confident that that is what these students are doing, and I feel like it is something whose bravery should be applauded and that people need to see it for what it is.
Can I ask you both a tiny little social note, but it intrigues me. The masks that students were wearing at Columbia and elsewhere, what do the masks mean in terms of anonymity, fear perhaps, maybe a certain suppression of ego? We're all in this thing together, anonymously. What do the masks mean?
It's designed to protect them from retaliation, a retaliation that we know and we have seen is being practiced and targets individual students as frequently as possible. The mass suspensions at Barnard, at Columbia, and elsewhere are targeting students who are identified in these organizing efforts, even before the encampments. And also, I'll note, it's also a safety issue. COVID is still circulating, and these students are all, they're in a camp in an enclosed space, living outside, often in kind of temperamental weather. And, you know, it's helped keep people healthy and safe and, you know, comfortable living in such close quarters with one another.
I would just add to that, that the level of surveillance that these student activists are being subjected to is, in my experience, unprecedented. When I was in college and I was their age some years ago, it was at the moment of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan after 9/11. And since then, just the technological sophistication that both university and state personnel are deploying in order to surveil student protesters is, it's extraordinary. So, you know, we have campus safety officers, so-called, at NYU who are surveilling students throughout the day on their personal phones, as well as on university, you know, camcorders and cameras. There's huge civil rights questions about what happens to that footage, right? You know, the official policy of NYU campus safety is that they only film when there is a kind of incident of aggression or hostility taking place. But I had to speak to a lieutenant in the campus safety office that she had taken footage when my daughter and the other kids were playing with chalk on the ground. And I said, I don't think that, you know, NYU has the right to surveil my daughter. You know, I think there's important questions about that. There's also, I counted three drones and three helicopters over the protests of about 200 people that took place after the encampment on was swept on Friday on Bleecker Street, right? There's also the case that people are surveilling these students who are neither state nor university personnel. There's just an incredible amount of harassment. And I mentioned earlier that the NYPD had spokesperson had gone on TV with a enlarged copy of the very short introduction to terrorism. But I felt like that was sort of emblematic of a certain kind of tendency to blow things out of proportion that we're seeing. And there have been on the plaza that's now closed, Gould Plaza, where the first encampment was, there were just people, I don't know who they were, presumably they worked for Zionist special interest groups, who were just hanging around with these enormous telephoto lenses And they had put up these posters on a scaffolding that were the Israeli propaganda posters. And they would just sort of wait across the plaza, recording all day, waiting for a student or passerby, right, because it's a public thoroughfare, to take them down. And one of those people was caught on camera taking down the poster and then lost his job, right? So he was a faculty member here, not a tenured faculty member, but on a limited contract. And so there's just so many reasons why these people are wanting to protect their identities, to protect themselves from harassment, surveillance, and so forth.
Let me ask you both. Zach Samelin at NYU, Sophia Azeb at UC Santa Cruz. A different question, but it involves the rest of the 2024 campaign. This is a huge event in the middle of our presidential election year. I'm wondering what effect this whole siege on the American campus gets into our 2024 consciousness. I mean, we're talking about a deep blues in American politics. We don't know what it's about anymore, or what we're looking for. You speaking of transformation, Zach, sort of catches my ear. Other issues that we worry about but don't talk about: our imperial role in the world, the wars we're engaged in but do not win, barely believe in, our inheritance in a colonial place in the world after the British Empire, again, never discussed. What would it take to bring some of this broader spirit, this concern about surveillance, for example, police behavior, into a broader coalition, not just around Gaza, but using the Gaza wake-up call as a fresh start?
Something that comes to mind is noting that at several of these encampments, notably at Cal Poly Humboldt, students were clearly using knowledge that they had gained in their years of so-called school safety drills, which is to say, if a gunman walks into your high school or your middle school or your elementary school, to barricade the police and keep them out of their building occupation at Cal Poly Humboldt. And to see an entire generation of university students who have been trained to fear and expect gun violence in their own schools, the places that they should feel safe, mobilize that training to barricade against the police, who they know to be a source of, and as we have seen and Zach has mentioned, the main source of violence at these encampments, in the wake of several years of emerging and reemerging calls for the sanctity of Black lives, observing two, maybe and a half, unprecedented economic recessions, knowing that they'll likely never get to own a house, have a family. I mean, the entire situation of the U.S., I mean, even barring the U.S.'s foreign relations disasters, which, of course, they've also grown up in a country that has always been at war for most of their lives. There is very little about electoral politics that's inspiring to these students. And I think the sooner that, let's say, mainstream, perhaps Democratic politicians realize that, the better. But I don't think that that would even inspire students of today becoming at all invested in electoral politics. They grew up in a world at war, a world in which all of the things that the generations before them may have had access to are no longer available, and a world in which the climate is disintegrating. The entire world is, as my students would say, you know, actually, I can't say what my students would say on public radio. The whole world is a mess. I think the difference, though, is that this generation clearly feels that they can actually make a difference. And that is the spirit of these encampments and the months and months and months of organizing that preceded them on college campuses and in communities, and city council resolutions being proposed for a ceasefire, and so on and so forth. They clearly feel empowered in a way that I personally haven't seen since the invasion of Iraq. But I remember how quickly that energy dwindled then. This is not dwindling. This is, in fact, I think, growing. Yeah. And what these administrators on these campuses cannot seem to grasp, and I don't understand how, is that the more that they repress and shut down these encampments, the more that spring up. I mean, without Manoush Shafiq, the president of Colombia, so violently shutting down the Colombia encampment, none of the rest of them possibly would have ever sprung up in the first place. It was students watching their peers at Columbia and Barnard be violently attacked by police that inspired them to put themselves also at risk and in harm's way. And they expect the violence and they're not afraid of it. And that's something that I think is quite distinct in this moment.
Yeah.
What's the chance that around the world, which is full of protests over the war on Gaza, what's the chance that these students are, in fact, saving the reputation of our country? It feels a very American enterprise that they're engaged in.
I think they would maybe be somewhat offended to hear that. But
it's certainly democratic.
It's definitely democratic. Yeah. I think it's also internationalist enterprise, yeah. Right? They see themselves, yes, as American, of course, but in relation with the rest of the world rather than isolated, which I think is how many sort of groundings and what it means to be American are focused on this isolationism, this exceptionalism. But these students see themselves as deeply in relation and responsible to the rest of the world. Yeah. And they're cultivating that energy. And that's the difference that I'm seeing. Another difference I'm seeing is this emphasis on relationality and being accountable to one another in these camps, but also, you know, to their peers around the world to say, we are American, and that needs to mean something different.
Yeah.
What do you pick up in the way of an anti-Semitic vibration, much less anti-Semitic discourse? And we're all, in a degree, alert for anti-Semitism. What are you hearing on your campuses?
Well, I would say, in response to that, and I understand that this is something that people are very concerned about around this country right now and across Europe as well. My entire family is Jewish. I'm Jewish. I've encountered anti-Semitism in my life. I'm somebody who would, I think, be sensitive to something like that. And I would just say that in my experience, this is one of the most spurious and obscene weaponizations of the discourse of anti-Semitism that I've ever encountered in my life that's been going on in these last 7 months. And this has been part of the way that the state of Israel has promoted its colonial interests and military interests for decades. But what we're seeing right now is the co-optation and kind of metastasization of that weaponization of anti-Semitism throughout the American political landscape. I would just remind anybody who's listening that there is nothing Jewish about the bombs that the United States is manufacturing and sending to Israel to drop on Palestinian people's families' houses, right? There's nothing Jewish about genocide or about causing mass starvation. And likewise, there's nothing anti-Semitic about speaking out against those atrocities. And the fact that those things are being linked, again, metonymically, like the counterterrorism and anti-protest unit of the NYPD, is quite alarming. Should be alarming to anybody. And in my opinion, it should certainly be alarming to Jews, right? Why should Jewish identity be connected to this degree of genocidal violence? It's atrocious. And certainly the people in the United States Congress who are manufacturing that connection and interested in promoting it are not people who I would ever in my lifetime have thought of as allies to Jews or as people who were really concerned with anti-Semitism. On the contrary, they're often right-wing figures who have absolutely given license to neo-fascist groups across this country who are in fact anti-Semitic and are responsible for things like the Tree of Life mass killing in Pittsburgh that took place some years ago. So there's a degree of hypocrisy and just, I think, cynicism, right? Because it winds up having this sort of effect of degrading the discourse of anti-Semitism. I mean, anti-Semitism is something, obviously, anybody who has been paying attention to modernity should know that this is something you want to be on the lookout for. And you don't want to degrade it and debase it and water it down and confuse it and turn it into something where you're protecting people's political interests by pretending. And, you know, this is something I feel quite strongly about. And I also feel like it's something that has been one of the sort of functions that this weaponization of anti-Semitism has, is to distract from the just, you know, heinous violence against Palestinians, right? We're worried about anti-Semitism on U.S. campuses. I'm not aware of a single substantiated incident of anti-Semitism taking place on NYU, right? We're worried about anti-Semitism on U.S. campuses when there are no longer any universities in Gaza. They've all been destroyed. Dozens and dozens of faculty have been murdered. Hundreds and thousands of students have been murdered. University presidents have been assassinated, right? And we're worrying here about whether or not a particular slogan might be able to be possibly construed as something that's offensive to people whose Judaism is completely wedded to their Zionist ideals. I think it's cynical and I think it's dangerous. And if we could just move past it, I would be happy to do so. And it's unfortunately the case that you have to keep returning and returning to this topic. I have a Palestinian colleague here who has lost family members. She has not received any condolences from any administrator at NYU. She has not had any acknowledgement. I don't think that to this day that the president of NYU has publicly used the word Gaza, maybe once, right, in any of the countless missives that she sent to the university communities for the last 7 months, right? But anti-Semitism, we've heard so much about, and yet we have no substantiated incidents of anti-Semitism. But in my mind, it's just really important. We're not seeing any kind of anti-Semitism going on in these protest demonstrations and encampments.
Let me ask Sophia Azed, what does your radar pick up on the anti-Semitism scale at Santa Cruz?
Likewise, any sort of instance of like a possible anti-Semitic incident has been traced back to right-wing students or community members rather than advocates for Palestine or the end to this genocide. I will say, though, and I agree with Zach, the word Palestine or Palestinian is rarely used by college administrators. And we actually see this example at the federal level. I recall a press interview with White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, in which she almost said the word Palestine and spent approximately 40 seconds stumbling over how not to say Palestine. The Palestinian people is something that I think is approved, but like federal officials are not allowed to use the word Palestine because to recognize the potentiality or the reality of a past Palestinian state is too dangerous. I just have not seen myself any correlation to any actual anti-Semitic incidents that have sparked from pro-Palestine organizers. It seems to be all from the right, which we know is actually consolidating around anti-Semitism in this country.
Right.
I'd ask you both, place Santa Cruz and NYU on the general map of American universities. Who are your friends out there? Who are the administrations? Where are the students that you particularly admire for what they've done? There are so many examples, and they're all different. Brown compromised with its protesters. USC canceled its graduation. Where are your models, and who's following your model?
So my example is our students.
Yeah.
It has to be the students. And it's important to know, again, like we as faculty are following their lead. We are not leading them.
Yeah.
They are teaching us right now what it means to be fearless, what it means to be brave, what it means to take a stand. And, you know, as we have repeatedly told our students here at UCSC in the encampment, like, we're not here to feed you kind of leadership or tell you how to organize this. We're here to fulfill whatever you need us to fulfill, to do whatever we can to support you, to follow your lead entirely.
Yeah, I would agree completely.
Name an institution that seems to have figured this out.
In my analysis, there is not a single person who is in proximity to the levers of power who is willing to say the thing that is true right now. There is not a single person who has their finger next to the levers of power who is willing to do the right thing or to stand up even for their students' right to speak and think about Palestine in this sustained way that we're seeing students taking it upon themselves to do. We have Brown. We have the example of Wesleyan, where the president has certainly been less repressive. He openly called for a ceasefire a couple of months ago. There was the president of the Union Theological Seminary that's, you know, affiliated in some way, I'm not totally sure how, with Columbia and Barnard, who said very clearly that they would never call the police in, which seems a little bit like a low bar in terms of talking about doing the right thing. But it is still in this moment worth noting and making a record of what people say they're not willing to do. But again, and I would completely agree with Sophia that this is about students who are making things possible and faculty who are paying attention to the students and, you know, are listening to them are able to see that.
We all imagine how the history we're part of will be remembered. Take a guess how history, even 5 years down the road, 10 years, will remember this spring of 2024 on the campuses of the United States. What's your hope? What's your fear?
Well, 5 to 10 years down the line, I think that these encampments will likely still be demonized. But as we know from how we look back at the Iraq War and the protests of the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, I think 15 to 20 years down the line, we'll be like, they were right. They were right the whole time. But I don't have a ton of faith in our current media landscape that popular memory will be kind to these encampments. But I know that students' organizing memories and organizers' memories will be very much celebrating what these students have achieved in the face of such oppression.
Zach, where will this stand in the great timeline of the American experiment?
There's something really, to me, unprecedented about this moment, insofar as it braids together so many distinct historical processes and movements that have previously been understood to be distinct, right? So again, I just think that there's something really powerful about that coming together. Obviously, the spirit of Occupy, the long history of the Palestinian struggle, the anti-imperialism of the kind of Iraq War and War on Terror era, and so on and so forth, right? There's like the student movements of the Vietnam era. I think there's a real sense that people are discovering the ways in which these different processes, including, of course, that transfer of imperial hegemony from the British Empire to the American Empire after World War II, have created the present that we're living in. And this moment, if it is part of this sort of long political experiment with democracy that hasn't always gone well in this country and oftentimes, you know, doesn't, then I think we have to admit that we really don't know what's going to happen because it's an experiment. And I'm continually haunted by the words that the Palestinian journalist Motaz Aziza said in an interview, I think while he was still in Gaza in, I think, November or December, where he said, speaking, I believe, to an American audience in a CNN interview, something along the lines of, don't say that you are a free person. Don't say that you're free if you're not able to stop a genocide from happening in your name, in the name of your country. And I think that people are really enacting a kind of realization of what he means, right? Which is, we like to think that we have lots of freedoms in this country, but now we see how much unfreedom there is connected to the destruction of the Palestinian people. And the extent to which we aren't free needs to be made apparent. And I think that's part of what people are undertaking right now at the level of student protest. And not just student protest. I mean, that people have been on and off campus for the last 7 months. But that sense of our unfreedom. People in the United States don't like to think of themselves as citizens of an empire. But we really are, right? Yeah, we really are, as much as you were in, you know, Victorian England. You know, it was just such a haunting phrase. Don't say that you're free. And now we see that we're not. We're not even free to speak or to gather together in order to be together and protest something that, you know. And so for me, that's part of this experiment. It's an experiment with revealing the kind of unfreedom of American society and the way that we're materially connected to the ongoing processes of destruction in Palestine, and of course in other places that the United States is involved. But, you know, there's obviously some particularly intense concentration of imperial energy over the question of Palestine.
Even if it hurts to face it. Zach Samelin at NYU, Sophia Azeb at UC Santa Cruz, thank you very much. I've heard and learned a lot in this conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Chris, for hosting this substantive conversation.
Zachary Samelin is professor of English at New York University. Sophia Azeb is professor of critical race and ethnic studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Here at Open Source, we depend on listener support. If you haven't done your part yet, do it now. Visit radioopensource.org/donate and pitch in to keep the world's first and longest running podcast going strong. Open Source is proud to be a member of Hub and Spoke, a Boston-based collective of independent, creator-owned podcasts. Our shows range from history to politics to art to technology. We come together around the principle that independent voices are more important than ever. You can learn more at hubspokeaudio.org. Thank you.